meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed. Read the signs. No time to hide. The winds have changed.
Millennia ago, from the little cave on the tiny island of Patmos in the Aegean Sea, the heavens opened. Since then, the world has been fascinated by the cosmic upheaval brewing on the horizon of history. The upheaval is now upon us. It is within us. To some degree, it always has been. But there has been a sudden and violent shift in the affairs of the world. The winds have changed. Heaven will not be silent. Let's now join Father Anthony Bush, pastor of St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago, and author of A Mother's Plea, For the Winds Have Changed. Together we can pave the way for a hopeful response to the signs of our times.
And good afternoon and welcome to Winds of Change. My name is Mary Helen Fiorito. I am the Cardinal Francis George Fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C., and I am sitting in as guest host today for Father Anthony. And our regular listeners know that Father Anthony is continuing to struggle with some health problems, and I know that he is very grateful for your thoughts and your concern and your letters and your prayers. But I'm wonderfully excited here to be joined by Bob Gilligan, who is the Catholic Conference of Illinois' Executive Director, because we have so much to talk about state politics-wise, don't we, Bob?
We do.
Yeah,
it's
there's a lot going on. And there's... so, Bob, I'm very grateful that you took the time to be,
here
with us. And Bob, as I mentioned, is the Executive Director of the Catholic Conference of Illinois, which serves as the lobbying arm for the different bishops who are in the state of Illinois. So Bob's concerns range everything from the Catholic schools here in Chicago to concerns of our rural dioceses that are in more farm-based communities, to some of the concerns with poverty and other issues in downstate Illinois. So Bob really has to be a master of a lot of different types of issues and has to bring the church's perspective on those issues to the Illinois General Assembly. So Bob is working off all of his purgatorial time here on earth, day to day, down there in Springfield, trying to convince our state legislators that the church's perspectives and the expertise that we bring to bear on social justice and education issues might be worth considering when they cast certain votes. So, Bob, the one big subject matter that's become national news is the Illinois budget. And the way in which we, of course, as Catholics, have to be concerned about the budget because of the way in which it impacts so many of our ministries, including our charitable works at Catholic Charities and other similar institutions, but also our Catholic schools. So, Bob, can you give our listeners a bit of background on what's going on now, what just happened last week, if you could give us sort of the Reader's Digest version of that, and then how whatever decisions were made will impact? Let's start with the schools, and then we'll move on to social services. Yeah.
So I should probably correct something you said, that I know all these things in depth. I know everything about an inch deep and a mile wide.
So you're,
you know,
just enough to be dangerous.
Right,
yeah, okay.
Right. Then I turn to somebody and go, can you fill in the blanks here?
Okay, very good.
The budget situation is an interesting one. I think probably a friend of mine said when they passed this, he says, well, the good news is that we have a budget. And now everybody knows we have a budget, and it's going to cost them a lot of money to pay for the budget. So, yeah, the state last week, the General Assembly passed, I think people know, we have a revenue package, and the revenue package has been widely publicized. So basically, we're going to be paying a lot more in our income taxes. Our current rate of 3.75% is no longer. And as of January 1st, we're all going to be paying 9.5% is where we landed percent on our income taxes. The corporate tax rate goes up as well. The Chicago Tribune had a nice little picture yesterday on what that's going to cost.
I saw that was on the front page of the Sunday paper. And I think for the basic sort of middle income range family of four who say between the husband and wife, they each make $50,000. So say they earn $100,000, your taxes go up. Is it $2,500 almost?
It's
close
to
that.
I think it's actually about $1,500 when you net out deductions and that kind of thing. But that's a lot of money. I mean, that's some money. You're going to have to come up with at least $1,000, if not more, dollars that you didn't have to come up with last week. And I think, you know, the thing to keep in mind as we talk about the budget is, And we'll talk about this in a second, the services that are being funded, but we also have to remember where that money's coming from. And, you know, we try to keep these things in perspective when we're talking about how the state functions and how it raises the revenues to pay for the services it provides. People have to pay for that, and that money's got to come from somewhere. And so, you know, quite frankly, there's a concern that if, you know, that $1,000, let's say, you know, hypothetically, that comes out of that middle-income family, you know, that's less money for the church or for the community group or for whomever.
Or for Catholic school tuition, for people who need it, you know.
So these are real-world pressures on people when they say, okay, pass a budget, pass a budget. You know, I don't need to remind homeowners and or anybody in Cook County, you know, when you go to the store, you have to pay 7 cents for the bag.
Right.
Our sales taxes are 9.75% when you buy something. We just nearly avoided, but we probably won't get away, increase in the soda tax.
Right. That, and our property taxes are the highest in the
nation. Our property tax bill, we just got that the other day. So, you know, these things are having a cumulative effect on people, and I think it's important to point them out before we go and talk about, you know, what is funded. And I'm not trying to make an argument that we shouldn't fund these vitally needed social services, but I think the way to describe what the General Assembly did last week is they patched up a hole. That hole, though, it's still going to rain. It's still going to wear away. And if we don't do anything to address the reasons why we're spending so much money, that hole is just going to be back in 2 or 3 years, and we're going to have to patch it again, and we're going to have to pay more to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the governor's point is we need to do some structural reforms. Structural reforms that he's identified, and that would.
Well, what
help
does he mean by that?
Need.
When you say structural, that's a term that's been thrown a lot in this whole conversation. But I think for most people, that means like I got to put a new roof on. You're talking about structural reforms.
Yeah.
In terms of a budget, what does that mean?
The budget. The governor is saying that in order to avoid coming back in a couple years and raising taxes again, he wants to alleviate some of the burdens that are on businesses and on homeowners. I'll give you just two examples. So on businesses, right now, they pay an inordinate amount of money on something called workers' compensation.
Okay.
So he wanted to reform the system for how people get compensated if they get injured on the job. The governor's position and the General Assembly's position is if you're injured on the job and it's a direct result of your employment or something you would be doing, yeah, you should be compensated for that. But if, you know, you're on the way to the job and you slip and fall, well, does that mean that you can file for workers' compensation reform? So there are some technical things that the governor wanted to do and the General Assembly never quite agreed to that would have addressed some of the constraints upon businesses, because we all know businesses hire people, and that's how we get our jobs from. So that's just one example of what the governor wanted to do in terms of his structural reforms. The other structural reform that individuals can relate to is what he wanted to do was put a 4-year freeze on property tax increases. So he wanted to say to local cities and local counties, you cannot raise property taxes for 4 years. We need to let this simmer because people are getting really hurt by property tax increases. Well, the General Assembly said, okay, we'll freeze property taxes, but not for the city of Chicago, 17 other identified municipalities, and not for the purposes of paying pensions for fire and police and some other reasons. So the General Assembly was talking about property tax reform, but the governor said, well, that's not really property tax reform. That's loopholes you can drive a truck through. So we get into this conversation about structural reforms and what does it need. What does the governor need in order to pass to sign a tax increase? And what we saw happen is the General Assembly said, no, we're not going to do any of the structural reforms right now. They took their own version of structural reforms and kind of passed those, and they didn't pass what the governor wanted. But they were successful in passing the well-publicized income tax increase. So where we sit today is the income tax will go up. The structural reforms have been kind of put on the back burner. They're going to get to those later, maybe, kind of, we think. We're not really sure. And then from there, we're really not sure where we go.
Right.
I think going to your original question, though, is about what did they fund. And they did fund some things that were really needed. Catholic Charities, that I think I've talked about on this program before,
you have, yes.
Was able to receive their due for a program they run called the Community Care Program. So basically, the Community Care Program provides services to seniors to help them stay in their homes. So we all know as people age, they need more and more services, and sometimes families can and cannot do those. So Catholic Charities provides a service called the Community Care Program. They come in and they provide respite care for families. So, you know, the son or daughter can get out and, you know, for a time, and they'll bring meals into the elderly person's home. They'll clean up. They'll do those kind of services. These things are really needed for people who are older and with less income. So that program had been pretty much decimated. The General Assembly funded it. The General Assembly also funded some other programs we were watching for. Immigrant Services line item. Immigrant Services line item funds some of the work in our parishes. It helps immigrants get education so they can become citizens and become full vested members of our communities. So they funded those sort of programs. That's a good thing. For our hospitals and our healthcare services, they funded Medicaid back to a reasonable level that they can at least continue on sustaining till they get to the next year. So all those things are good. That keeps us through the through the year. We're going to do this all again in a couple months. There'll be a budget introduced in January. We're going to do all this, the whole thing again. They'll have to pass another budget in June of next year. The other thing that the budget did, and I don't want to forget this, is many families out there probably listening to this at some point in time have enjoyed what they call the educational tax credit.
Okay.
And for non-public parents, non-public school parents, they get a $500 write-off on their tuition.
Per family.
The max is per family. You can get up to $500. The General Assembly did increase that to $750. So for Catholic school parents, who almost all get that tax credit, they will now get $750 back from their taxes opposed to now the $500. So that's a good thing.
Okay.
So they did do some things that are good. Some things remain to be seen, and some things that we're still working on, and hopefully we'll figure that out in the next couple months.
Okay. Well, so here's one particular issue that kind of vexes me personally, but also I find it, a curiosity. So riddle me this, Joker. The House back in, the Illinois Senate back in May approved a bill, House Bill 40, which approved taxpayer funding of abortion. Now, we've just gone through all the really critical social services that our state, people really need,
right.
They'll suffer tremendous consequences and then could potentially really become, I don't want to use the word burdens, but the state's going to have to step in and help to provide their care.
Right.
So the Senate passed this House bill that allows for taxpayer monies to be used for elective abortions. So these are, now I would dispute medically that there's ever a need for abortion, medically speaking. But abortion is an elective procedure. We don't pay for other elective procedures with the state health insurance. We don't pay for, cosmetic surgery. We don't pay for vasectomies. We don't pay for things that, again, generally people, if they want, they go ahead and they pay for it out of their own pocket because, again, they're elective. Public opinion polls show regularly that the general public do not support publicly funded abortions, yet our Illinois Senate passed this bill. With everything going on budget-wise in Illinois, where did that vote come from? Where did they find the gall, frankly, to focus on publicly funding elective surgeries rather than, really hitting the work and addressing the needs that people really have?
It's devoid of a rational explanation, but I'll try anyway.
Okay, thank you, because I thought I was the only one that thought that.
No. And you bring up a good point. Services to people who are seniors, who are poor, and people who are developmentally disabled, no rational person argues against the state using money to help those individuals.
Right.
You don't get that. That's just not even a topic. But there is a topic in how the General Assembly, in this fiscally austere climate, where they had to raise taxes by I gave the percentages, but $5 billion, that amount is going to raise. They're going to raise an additional $5 billion through increasing the individual and the corporate tax credit. So how do they at the same time find it necessary to pay for, we guesstimate that public funding of abortion bill is probably going to cost about $30 million.
Mm.
Where are they going to come up with that money to do that? I mean, it makes absolutely no sense. The short answer to your question is the way they were able to pass that is, and they do this, they're very good about, I think the pro-abortion side is very good at masking their true intentions. The way they did it is they masked that bill in another provision in that bill, which would have allowed for, if the governor ever does sign it, and we'll talk about that in a second, but the legislation that the public funding of abortion provision is contained in also is in a bill that says that if Roe v. Wade were ever overturned, then abortion will still be remain legal in the state of Illinois.
It will go back to pre-Roe.
Right.
Yeah, it won't, so it won't be legal.
Right, but if this bill passes, it would still be legal.
It would remain, right, so it'll lock in Roe versus Wade.
Right, it locks in Roe v. Wade.
Right.
That's a better saying it. So that's how they do it. I've told this story in the past, but I remember when the bill was being heard in the House. The way Springfield works is that they have a bill, the sponsor presents the bill, then the proponents for the bill go first, and then the opponents talk second. And I testified for the opponents, so I spoke second. I'm listening to the proponents speak about House Bill 40, the bill you just described as publicly funding of abortions.
Right.
The proponents said nothing about that provision. They said nothing about it. It's absolutely nothing. All they talked about was the horrors that existed prior to 1972 and how women couldn't procure abortions. And I literally turned to somebody who's more versed in the details than I am on these bills, somebody who really follows amendments and things like that, an intern who was working for Illinois Citizens for Life. And I asked her, did they amend this bill? Did I miss something? Because
right.
I don't want to go up there and start talking about something that is not even in the bill.
Yeah.
I said to her, I said, did they take that out, the public funding portion? Because the proponents never talk about it. She looked at me and she laughed and she said, no, it's still in there.
Right.
I'm like, well, I'm going to be breaking news here to the members of the General Assembly because the proponents never talked about the – it was almost like we talked past each other the entire legislative debate. They said – we need this trigger bill to make sure abortion will still be legal,
right,
regardless of whether Roe v. Wade
passes. And what they mean
and
by that,
right. We talked
about
public funding. It was like we were talking about two entirely different things.
Right. So their strategy was to talk about the issue that would stir up the most controversy while
right.
at the same time sneaking in a provision that
right.
would provide for publicly funded abortions. Okay. So when we come back, we'll continue our conversation here with Bob Gilligan. This is Mary Fiorito sitting in for Father Anthony today on AM 750 WNDZ.
St. Stanislaus Kostka Church is the official sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago. Founded by Polish immigrants in the late 1800s, this historic church is more commonly known as St. Stan's. One church, many cultures, in that masses are held in English, Spanish, and Polish. The church is two blocks north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy. St. Stan's has been so prominent in the history of the church in Chicago that the Kennedy Expressway was even built around it. St. Stan's is easy to get to. It is the sanctuary for quiet prayer before the celebrated iconic monstrance. For Mass and confession times and special events, please visit our new website at ststanschurch.org. That's ststanschurch.org. And while you're on the homepage, feel free to click on the donations tab to help in the continuing restoration of St. Stan's.
The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ and on the World Wide Web at windsofchangeshow.com.
You've looked for the right school for your child, but what school? You've worked hard to instill right reason and the values that God has established. And yet, you might be concerned not only with your child's school's quality of education, but by what they may be teaching, maybe undermining what you have worked so hard to instill. Perhaps St. Stanislaus Kostka School could be the positive answer to your questions. Academic excellence and Christ-centered values are the hallmarks of St. Stanislaus Kostka School. To find out what may be the best opportunity for your child, visit ststanschicago.org. That's ststanschicago.org. See the videos, see the students, and see what may be the best decision you can make for your child. Contact the school online or pick up the phone and call St. Stanislaus Kostka School to arrange for a visit at 773-278-4560. That's 773-278-4560.
And welcome back. This is Mary Helen Fiorito. I am the Cardinal Francis George Fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C., and I am sitting in today for Father Anthony on listener-supported Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ. And we've been having an interesting conversation this afternoon with Bob Gilligan, the director of the Catholic Conference of Illinois, about the Illinois budget crisis, its resolution or sort of lack thereof. the kinds of things the budget was funding that we as Catholics would be supportive of, but also some of the things that are still sort of floating around the halls of the Illinois legislature that we have some serious concerns about. And one of them is a House bill, House Bill 40, which provides for public funding of abortions, which is something that obviously we morally have issues with. But also, additionally, the American public in general, when you poll them, and this has been fairly consistent statistically since 1973, people do not want to pay for other people's abortions. They see it as an elective procedure, which it is medically speaking. It actually interrupts a natural, healthy process. So the thought of taxpayers having to fund an elective surgery, like, you know, cosmetic surgery would be, or sterilizations for men would be, is really, you know, quite inconsistent with how most Americans think that, you know, government should operate in general. So this bill passed the Illinois House, passed the Illinois Senate, but didn't make it to the governor's desk.
No, it kind of got lost
along
the way.
So where is it? Is it an envelope someplace and the courier went out for lunch, or what happened to it?
It's probably aptly described as sitting in a state senator from Oak Park. His name is Don Harmon, probably in his desk. So this is a really interesting legislative maneuver. Well, it's interesting to me, but may not be interesting to others. But it is interesting. It's a little abnormal. So the legislature, Mary, as you indicated, the House passed this bill narrowly. I think it passed by one or two votes. The Senate passed the bill with a larger majority because the Senate is a little more liberal body, if you will. The bill did pass both chambers. And so those students of fifth grade, who passed fifth grade, know that next step is go to the governor, right? But there's actually a procedural step that has to be done in Springfield, is that the Senate has to transmit the bill to the governor.
Okay.
The governor can't
act. And
that's
like a formal process?
It's a formal process. Okay. Basically, they send a letter they're sending the bill to the governor's desk. And there is a formal process. There's a letter that goes along with that. But what happened, the bill never got transmitted to the governor.
Right.
Interesting enough. So what happened is one of the members of the state Senate, Don Harmon from Oak Park, a state senator, he reconsidered his vote. He voted in the affirmative. He voted for the bill. But before they could transmit it, they enacted a maneuver which he made a motion to reconsider his vote. And so because the senator filed that paperwork, the Senate as a body cannot transmit it to the governor for the governor to act upon. Listeners may know the governor has said publicly that he will veto that bill. So what happened, this happened a couple weeks ago, that because the senator made that motion to reconsider his vote, and by the way, he is not going to reconsider his vote from a yes to a no, but they are just doing this for political reasons, because it's our belief, we don't know any of this, but we think that what the Senate is doing, what the Democratic Party is doing, is they are going to hold this bill until there's a politically opportune time to send it to the governor to help embolden the majority party's base, i.e. those women that marched back in January and all that activity that we had. So they think that this issue is probably good for their base and they can use it to raise money, this issue being repeal of Roe v. Wade,
right,
and put the Republican governor in a position that he would be against, if you will, you know, women's rights. That's how they'll term it. So they've done this since they did this with 40, they've done it with a couple other bills. What is happening is they're playing politics with this issue and trying to hold it out. Now, listeners should know, they can hold that bill. They can send it to him tomorrow. Mm-hmm. They can do it the next day. They can do it next month. They can hold this legislation all the way till the end of Governor Rauner's term, which would be, if he doesn't win election, January 10th, 2019. So they can, now we don't know if Governor Rauner will win re-election or if he will lose re-election or if he even will run. So they could hold this right up to the bitter end.
He could sign it on his way out the door with no repercussions politically.
If he loses, or he could do anything. That's a very good question. We don't know what he would do.
So it has an expiration date.
It does have a shelf life of right until the end of the governor's term, correct.
Okay.
And that's not until January, the swearing in of the new governor, assuming that Governor Rauner runs and does not win re-election.
Okay, so
if this doesn't make sense, it's very confusing.
Let me ask. I mean, I do remember when I was in law school, when we did Roe and we had an Illinois state constitution class, and of course that is a very particular part, and many states have it, because Roe versus Wade and Doe versus Bolton did was to, now a lot of people, it's kind of a misnomer, they say it made abortion legal, but technically what it did was to overturn the state laws.
Correct.
That were on the books in all 50 states. And I believe at that time, California, Colorado, New York, and that was it. I mean, there might have been one more. So at the most, four states already had fairly liberal abortion laws on the books.
Correct.
Everyone else, through democratically elected representatives who had, gone back, spoken to their constituents, heard the viewpoints of doctors in their communities, heard the viewpoints of women and men and families, and state by state, the people had decided they did not want abortion to be legal in their
state. In 1972.
Correct. And so Illinois was one of those states.
Correct.
And there were attempts, of course, by organizations that even back in the 60s were looking to repeal abortion laws, but they were always pretty quickly and rather vociferously voted down because the people in the state did not want it. What happened when Roe versus Wade was decided was that the court said states cannot outlaw abortions. So Illinois, if you have a law that prohibits abortion for all 9 months for any reason, it's no longer constitutional and it's off the books. So what Illinois did was basically to, I think, express the anger of the people and the elected representatives, and rightly so, say, we're going to put something in our Constitution, Supreme Court, since you did this to us, and it violates what the people in the state wanted and what the medical community in the state wanted, that says that if this bad law is ever overturned, we're going to go back to the way the people in the state originally
right,
wanted.
Right, and they did that in 1975. It's
correct.
Called the Illinois Abortion Law of 1975.
Correct, right. So 2 years, legislators,
yep.
state
they
legislatures,
were angry,
right. They were very upset because they saw it for what it was, which was the Supreme Court coming in and over-legislating
them. Yeah,
they
usurped them. The state power.
Right. Correct. And
right.
they did the same thing with marriage. Because,
right. yeah.
you know, we saw this with the Obergefell case and redefining marriage. In every state in which marriage redefinition from a man and a woman to any two people was put to a public vote, it lost.
Even in California twice.
Correct. So every single state to which that question was put, the people overturned. The people said, we do not want this. We do not believe that this is what marriage is. And the Supreme Court did the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of a similar thing. And this is why sometimes people will refer to the Supreme Court as legislating from the bench.
Sure.
You know? And so at any rate, not to get too much off the sidetrack, but I just wanted to explain to our listeners that that's why this trigger law, as the pro-abortion site is calling it, is so important to them. They do not want the Illinois law to revert back to the way it was when the people could actually help to shape the law.
And to your point, to build on that, I think what the proponents of House Bill 40 saw, and it could happen, I'm not saying it will, but there could be another vacancy in the United States Supreme Court during President Trump's term.
Right.
We hear rumors often about Justice Kennedy.
Correct.
And we hear a lot.
Yeah, and there were some fairly strong rumors
about
a month ago.
Right.
Right.
I don't want to, that's speculation, but I would think that if there were another vacancy in the U.S. Supreme Court between now and the end of Governor Rauner's first term, whether he wins or loses, I think you would see activity on that bill again, which would put the Republican governor, Bruce Rauner, in a difficult situation. That's what the goal of that holding that bill is. If there's another vacancy, I think then you could see perhaps them sending it up to him and making him act upon it. And then you have probably more legitimate fear of the pro-choice community that, boy, there could be a case that could get to the court that would review the provisions of Roe v. Wade, which is mm-hmm. their worst nightmare, but our dream.
Right. And just, you know, again, as I speak to audiences or do radio interviews, I'm often struck by the number of people who don't understand the breadth of the abortion law in our country. And and Roe and Doe, so Roe versus Wade had a companion case called Doe versus Bolton that essentially legalized abortion for all 9 months for any reason.
Sure.
And that's why, you know, in the Western world, the United States, Canada, have the most extreme abortion laws in the Western world, and then only communist China and North Korea match ours that allow it up until the moment of birth. So, it's rather shocking, and I think a lot of people don't know that. So,
well, didn't Cardinal George used to talk about, like, Iran and Iraq and saying, like, you can't even do this in
right.
the Middle East.
Yeah, where they can throw people off buildings for things. So, right, exactly. And it is rather astounding when you think of
it's horrible,
of the depth of the harm that these extreme abortion laws have caused to so many people. Yep. So, okay, well, without getting too much off into that tangent, I want to bring it back, our conversation, Bob, back to the schools.
Sure.
Because the Catholic schools in the state of Illinois, but particularly in the Chicago area, are such a lifeline for so many families, and
that's right.
Literally in some cases. And I was just telling, I was at a parish event yesterday at my parish, and I was telling someone about one of my favorite columns that Mike Royko, who was for many years a columnist with the Chicago Daily News, and then the Chicago Times, sometimes, and then the Chicago Tribune, finally, up until the time of his death. But he wrote an excellent column once about his younger brother. I believe his mother was raising them alone. I'm not sure if she was widowed or if the parents were divorced, but it was him and his younger brother, and they lived in Humboldt Park, which is a neighborhood that can have some rough elements, and even back then in the 50s it had rough elements, and he was starting to cause a lot of trouble at the public school he went to. So his mother did the only thing she knew how to do, and she said she put him in a Catholic school. She put him in a Catholic high school, and she said the first day, Royko recalls this in a column, the kid brother is sitting at a desk, and I think it must have been a resurrectionist school, because he mentions a resurrectionist brother. So it was either, that could have been Gordon Tech. It could have been, I'm trying to think of the other schools. Weber, probably. It might have been Weber High School. And asked him a question, and he said the kid brother gave a smart aleck response. And he said the next thing the kid brother remembers was opening his eyes and seeing the ceiling, because he'd been knocked to the floor. And this is not to, of course, to minimize the harms done by corporal punishment. That's certainly not what's done. But he said, Mike Royko said, listen, that lesson took. And my brother went on to never miss a day of school, to go on to college, and he became the CEO of a fairly significant mid-sized company in Cleveland or something. And he said, but he traces, my brother himself traces his success back to that day.
Sure.
When he was actually disciplined and he was told, no, there's a certain code of conduct here. You are here to learn, young man. Yeah. You are not here to cause trouble or to be disrespectful. And so, Royko based this story, did his little, trip down memory lane. He said, I have a point in telling this story. And that is because the Catholic community, particularly politicians, needs to recognize the not only the financial gift the Catholic schools provide to taxpayers, because if we had to, put all these kids in Catholic schools, public schools, there would be no room for them, but the increase in property taxes would be astronomical. But also to talk about the sort of ripple effects of having Catholic education in a city, because we turn out such well-educated, respectful people who really go on to be tremendous contributions to society. So tell me, with the new budget, how did that impact the schools, and how is it going to affect the school systems, not only here in Chicago, but, because, I don't want to discount downstate, some of their school systems as well?
Yeah, that's a good question, and so many things I can unmention based on what you just said. It's interesting. I've had a lot of conversations with Cardinal Supich and the legislative leaders in the last 10 days, and the cardinal has used the word you used, lifeline. We are a lifeline to people in that community, and the bishops have said the same thing. And so there's two points I want to make. First of all, the budget does contain some decent news, some good news for Catholic school parents. As I said before, the $500 tuition tax credit that is currently eligible for sending their kids to Catholic and non-public school is now going to move to $750. So
although
it's a little relief for them.
It's a little, but Bob, it's a drop in the bucket compared
sure.
to, I can tell you, I have
sure.
two kids in Catholic high school,
no doubt about it.
One in Catholic grade school, and the total cost of the tuition for those three children is $46,000.
Yeah,
and so $750. I'm grateful.
It's a
month of groceries,
sure.
I guess.
Right.
But
that
doesn't
nothing,
even
but,
well.
No.
It doesn't even begin
right.
to touch the cost of the sacrificial giving that Catholic parents make and non Catholic parents make to
Absolutely.
Send their kids to our school. Well, Bob, we're going to go to a break, and when we get
sure.
back, we'll continue this conversation about the Illinois budget and Catholic schools. This is Mary Fiorito sitting in today for Father Anthony on listener-supported Winds of Change.
You've looked for the right school for your child, but what school? You've worked hard to instill right reason and the values that God has established, and yet you might be concerned not only with your child's school's quality of education, but by what they may be teaching, maybe undermining what you have worked so hard to instill.
Perhaps St. Stanislaus Kostka School could be the positive answer to your questions. Academic excellence and Christ-centered values are the hallmarks of St. Stanislaus Kostka School. To find out what may be the best opportunity for your child, visit ststanschicago.org. That's ststanschicago.org. See the videos, see the students, and see what may be the best decision you can make for your child. Contact the school online or pick up the phone and call St. Stanislaus Kostka School to arrange for a visit at 773-278-4560. That's 773-278-4560.
The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ and on the World Wide Web at windsofchangeshow.com.
The best candidate for marriage is the very person who would be a good candidate for monasticism. And the best candidate for monasticism would be the very person who would be a good candidate for marriage. I'm Father Thomas J. Loy with a Theology of the Body moment for the Tabor Life Institute. Celibacy and marriage are not opposed to each other. They're actually two sides of the same coin. Marriage and celibacy are both choices to love, to make a gift of self, to live spousally. Happy marriages are those which have the element of the monastic in them, prayer, discipline, dying to self, and a sense of belonging ultimately to God. A celibate is happiest when he or she lives their celibacy spousally, making a gift of self to God and to others. The married couple reminds the celibate of the spousal dimension of his or her celibacy. The celibate reminds the married couple of the sacramental nature of their marriage. To find out more about the theology of the body, visit taborlife.org. Taborlife.org.
And welcome back. This is Mary Helen Fiorito. I'm sitting in today for Father Anthony on Winds of Change here on AM 750 WNDZ. And my guest for the past 45 minutes has been Bob Gilligan, who is the director of the Catholic Conference of Illinois. And we've been talking about budgetary matters in the state of Illinois. That's been such a, you know, topic of conversation in media, and it's become a national story because of the budget impasse that we had. And we were discussing the implications for the new budget on the Catholic schools in particular. And so, Bob, tell us a little bit about, you know, we have the $750 tax credit, which I'm, again, grateful for, but it's not going to go a long way. What else in terms of support for these neighborhood lifelines?
Yeah, this is the one that we're still working on. And for people who think the budget is over, we don't think it's over yet. So this gets so into the weeds. So I'll try to make this as simple as I possibly can. So the budget that was passed, there was when we say the budget, we're talking about two things. We're talking about revenues, that's the tax increase, and then we're talking about a spending plan, how they're going to spend the money. So both of those things passed. The governor vetoed it. They overrode his veto, so they become law. In the spending plan, we think that the way it's worded, this gets into legalese, but I'll stop here. So we basically think that because the spending plan was worded in such a way, the public schools cannot get their money. They're not going to open. Oh. They're not going to open up in August unless the legislature goes back and amends another bill that's on the governor's desk. That bill is known as Senate Bill 1, or what they call in Springfield the funding formula. So there's been a big issue in Springfield forever that I think most listeners know, that the state does not fund school districts equitably. It is felt that in the suburban areas, that the legislature wants to take money from the suburbs and give it to the city and downstate because they don't get funded adequately. So the legislature passed this funding formula bill that changes all that. The end result of the funding formula bill is that Chicago Public Schools is in line to get about a $377 million block grant. Mm-hmm. They changed the funding formulas such that the suburban districts basically lose.
Okay.
The governor does not like this. He is going to veto this bill. Because they can't spend the money in the spending plan, they have to go back and they have to talk about Senate Bill 1, which is the funding formula bill.
Okay.
So what we've been trying to do and advocate for a long period of time is to enact something called the Scholarship Tax Credit. And a scholarship tax credit is basically this. Most listeners are probably familiar with Big Shoulders. Big Shoulders raises a lot of money. It's a scholarship granting organization. So when people give money or corporations give money to Big Shoulders, they get a donation, which is a percentage of what they give. What we are trying to do is create the law such that it would be a credit. So it's a dollar for dollar match on what they give. It's capped at a certain amount because it couldn't be endless because there's a hit to the state budget. So what we are trying to do, and the reason we're doing that is if individuals and corporations can get a credit as opposed to donations, we know, because it's been done in other states,
right,
that the total giving goes up a lot. And so what we're hoping to do is create a bigger pool of money, and that's used to fund scholarships for middle and lower income families so they can attend a non-public school. So what we would do is form an SGO, a scholarship granting organization, like Big Shoulders, in Chicago and in Belleville and other portions of the state. It's not only Catholics that would do this. Agudath Israel, the Jewish school system, they're interested in it. The Lutherans are interested in it. So this would raise giving in all for all those communities such that they could form a scholarship granting organizations used to provide scholarships to lower and middle income individuals.
Well, that's interesting because I think for many Catholic parents, you know, and I send all of my kids to Catholic schools, there certainly seems to be a sense among many of them that there are scholarships available for the kids on the sort of very poor end of the spectrum.
Yes.
So what happens, and this is something that's a tremendous concern for me, sort of the middle class, the working and middle class, A, don't think they qualify for anything, and B, they're the first ones to leave. In fact, we had a couple of families left the school
Can't
where my daughter attends, and you would, you know, but they, in terms of all of their other financial obligations, unfortunately, and, you know, and they, we live in an area where there's very good public schools, and they just, they didn't see the need to keep their kids in Catholic schools. And you know, that for me is the most painful thing to hear, because, and that's a topic for another show, I think.
Right.
But I think if our schools were more explicitly Catholic, parents would see a greater reason to keep their children there.
Preaching
because,
the choir.
Yeah, I this is not to disparage the CCD programs and the religious ed programs and the people who work so hard to try to make those really good substantive and, you know, life-changing programs for the kids. However, you get the and they are for some of them, but you get those kids 1 hour a week.
Yeah, right.
And there is, as I always, you know, like to say, there is nothing 1 hour a week can ever come close to comparing to going through Lent in a Catholic school.
Right.
Because you know it's Lent. You know it's Lent at every turn, every time during the day. Same with Advent, same with the liturgical seasons. So the day-to-day immersion in the Catholic culture is such a critical part of kids' formation when they're young. So that's my opinion on that. But so that's good to know that it's a potentially, at least.
We're in the mix. Make no promises that this will pass. We, like I said, because of this kind of glitch that was maybe intentional. This sort of, some people have referred to it as a poison pill in the spending plan that's going to cause them to go back. We hope that the governor will use this as leverage to say to the legislature, okay, if you want this funding formula change, if you want this block grant for CPS minus some changes, then I need some other things. And here's what I need. And there's a list of a couple things, but this is in the queue in terms of the number of things that the governor is pushing for and many other people in the legislature are advocating for, both Democrats and Republicans. The key for us is, do we have enough? Can we make this as a part of the final mix? And can we get this program solidified such that it would be something we can work with and will really help provide some financial assistance to, as you indicated, not only the lower income families, but also middle income families. And that's really what our goal is, to make it more affordable for everyone. It's easier said than done. But I should add that this has been done in other states. Pennsylvania has this, Florida has this. Many other states have enacted scholarship tax credit programs, and they've been very successful. As a matter of fact, I think the state of Georgia did it. And the way it works
is, I've heard about Georgia's
program. January 1st, you can apply for the grants. And they started at, like, you know, midnight, or rather, you know, the toll of midnight on December 31st. You could start applying January 1st. And by, like, the end of New Year's Day, all the grants were taken. I mean, they had that much pent-up demand to give.
Sure.
To fill up these organizations. It was just overwhelming. So,
you
know, we'll start at probably a relatively low amount. We don't know the figure amount yet. But, well, I mean, I think this is one of those programs that if we can get this passed— even if it's at a low dollar amount, you know, 50, 75, whatever, million dollars, whatever that figure is, I know we'll fill up these scholarships in a nanosecond, and we'll demonstrate to the legislature this is a program that's worked. There's a huge pent-up demand for this. I am confident in Illinois we'll be able to do that. And I say we, the Catholic school system, but I think the Lutheran school system, the as I mentioned, the Jewish school system, all of us want this program. So it will be effective if we can pass it. That's
right.
The key.
And hard I think, to get you know, through. Right. Talking about the key, maybe the key to this is to try to you know, emphasize to taxpayers, this is saving you money ultimately.
Because it saves money. It's a good educational opportunity. But the hurdle we're up against, as I think most listeners and you know, that there is a belief out there, unfortunately, this is a real strong belief, that any dollar has to go to the public school system. And I mean, the Constitution right. in Illinois says that the state is responsible for educating all Illinois school children, not
Correct.
Just those
right.
in public school systems.
Right.
But
and
yeah, it's a battle. But yeah, we've been fully engaged in this, and so we're hoping.
Well,
I'm
grateful to hear that because yeah. you know I know the number of people who either leave and go to a good public school system, or for many you know more serious Catholic families, they homeschool.
Yeah,
and that's become a great. I mean, that you know, 20
thing.
Years ago, 25 years
of.
Ago, that was yeah, exactly. You were you know you would look. Not
yep.
just twice, but three times at someone who told you they were homeschooling.
Yeah.
Now it's extremely mainstream.
Yeah.
I know more families
Me too.
That do it. And,
Me too.
And they tend to be larger Catholic families
yep.
who will be very clear, we can't afford the parish school. And yes, Father, our pastor, has said he'll support us up to a certain point, but he cannot support our family at the level we need to be
and
able to send
ago,
our kids.
Years ago, that same family, that same characteristic was in the Catholic school system.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
and
a
so now you're
ago.
Right. You're not seeing the
right.
really we have a couple at our school. I'm very grateful that they're there. But you're not seeing the super large, wonderful big Catholic families
yeah,
that you know with a kid in every grade sort of thing.
Yeah.
So all right, so Bob, well thank you. That's
mm-hmm.
a very helpful, I think, summation for our listeners of the current Illinois budget activities and impasses and how they're going to affect us. But I'd like to switch now for the time that we have remaining to another Illinois issue. But this has to do with a law that has already been passed and has been signed, unlike some of the other things we've been discussing this afternoon. And that is Senate Bill SB, as it's called, Senate Bill 1564, which
mm-hmm.
is a bill that requires crisis pregnancy centers, pregnancy resource centers, Catholic hospitals, Catholic doctors, and other medical personnel to refer women for abortions and to abortion providers if they are asked. So up until this point, if you were a pregnant woman and you were, say, at a Catholic hospital and you said to your physician, you know, halfway through the pregnancy, I think I'd like to have an abortion. I'm not going to go forward with this pregnancy. Prior to this, all the doctor needed to say, or the hospital administration needed to say, was, we don't provide those services here.
Didn't have to say anything, right?
Right.
Nothing.
Or nothing at all.
Right.
Other than, we are here if you need
right.
us and you change your mind, we are here for you. Now, the new law says that the provider must not just say, oh, let me tell you where you can get that abortion, but you actually have to provide a list of abortion providers or abortion clinics where the woman, I believe the law says,
reasonably believe she may obtain
an abortion. So this has obviously been tremendously difficult. It's been signed into law. The governor signed it on January 1st. Although in the same breath, he says he's not really elected to be a governor on social issues.
That's
he
right.
doesn't want to be involved in social issues. He wants to, really just kind of be there for budgetary and financial issues, and he's, hands off on moral issues. He was hands on this bill, which has been, tremendously debilitating, in particular to Catholic OBGYNs who are in private practices,
sure.
who practice on their own, but in a very particular way to pregnancy centers.
Yep.
And Bob, you and I, in terms of full disclosure, both Bob Gilligan and I serve on the board of Aid for Women, which is a pregnancy center with five locations in the Chicago area, five counseling centers, and then two maternity homes. And Bob and I are both really privileged to serve this wonderful nonprofit organization. It was founded by a Catholic deacon, and so very much has Catholic moral teaching and Catholic sensibilities, which undergird all of its activities. And Aid for Women was one of four entities that participated in a lawsuit against Governor and the state of Illinois' the health regulations department,
Department of Financial and Professional Regulation,
to sue the state, and was granted a temporary injunction against the law applying to us, because the judge, and rightly so, I think in both of our opinions, saw this as government-compelled speech, a violation of First Amendment religious liberty and free speech rights, saw a significant potential for us to prevail in this case. And so Aid for Women, thankfully, can continue on business as usual, counseling women and helping them. However, the rest of the pregnancy centers in the state are not covered.
Right.
And at the moment. And unfortunately, fortunately and unfortunately, at Aid for Women, we've seen a tremendous increase in the number of clients because the other pregnancy centers can't see them right now and can't counsel them the way in which they, because the government has mandated what they must and must not say. So all of those additional clients are coming over to Aid for Women. And so, Bob, let's talk about this law a little bit. Can you tell me sort of a little bit of the legislative history of the bill?
Sure.
How did we get here?
How did we get here? We get here through, you're going to thank your friends at the American Civil Liberties Union.
Okay.
They have a project called the Reproductive Justice Project or Reproductive Rights Project, and they do a very thorough job. They are very well funded. They have some very astute lawyers who monitor any little incident that happens at a Catholic hospital. That's how we got here.
Okay.
And so they had reason to believe that they found a couple women, and I don't want to, because I'm not in a position to say whether these stories are accurate or not, but they have a couple women who have come forward, and they have some pretty bad stories about how they were allegedly treated at a Catholic hospital. To be fair, we don't know the full story. We only hearing one side of the story,
right?
As you can imagine,
and of course, their testimony was really written in a very dramatic way,
compelling tears. Yes, and that is provokes a lot of emotion. And whenever you're in a situation like that in a legislative hearing in Springfield, you're on the defensive, especially as somebody representing a large institution that has a lot of employees and a lot of policies and procedures. And as you can imagine, you have one person stand up and say they've been wronged in a bad way. And to be fair, the ethicist who I had consulted with during this legislative debate all said, if this is true about what this one woman in particular is saying, is we made a mistake, and mistakes happen. You know,
right.
I don't think anybody here is saying that these things are not impossible. Some of the stories are a little more believable than others.
Well, they seemed, some of them were
There's different stories.
We're so far-fetched as to truly almost to be unbelievable.
Yeah, but you know, is it possible? Sure, it's possible. Anything's possible. So that's how we got here, and so the ACLU wrote a bill that was something that nobody could live with: the Catholic hospitals, the Catholic bishops, and so what happened in essence was, if the original legislation that was passed had passed, it would basically put Catholic hospitals in a situation where I don't know if they would continue. I don't know what they would have done. They would have made the decision as whether they could operate or bring litigation or what have you. So there were a lot of negotiations and words were changed. And so what we got was this amorphous phrase. The legislation, according to the bishops and the Catholic hospitals, is does not qualify in Catholic social teaching as a direct referral. Everything else outside of that is nebulous and open to interpretation. So the phrase, as you said before so aptly, reasonably believe may, what does that mean? So
right.
People have taken that in different interpretations. The crisis pregnancy centers say we're interpreting that to mean that we can't even reasonably believe refer somebody to for anything, because we were set up as direct counter to somebody seeking an abortion. So we're not even going to go on that field. We don't want to talk about abortion. We'll only talk about the hazards of abortion in that context. We are not going to talk about the benefits. The benefits of abortion are
we don't
there
believe
are none.
There are benefits
there are
to abortion.
There are none.
Right.
So that's how we got in this situation. And as you described, the situation we're in now is, gratefully, Aid for Women is protected by this judge's decision. Unfortunately, no other crisis pregnancy center is in the state. And so therefore their interpretation of Senate Bill 1564 is that they don't feel comfortable in counseling anybody. They don't feel comfortable in talking about this. So the situation has resulted, as you said, is that Aid for Women has been left as, if you will, you know, last man standing or last entity standing. So all of the calls, all of the counseling requests are coming to Aid for Women because they are protecting a kind of a protected status right now.
Right.
So, you know, the phone's ringing off the hook. The requests for counseling are multiplied tenfold, whatever it has been. And, you know, as we've jokingly said, business is good. And that's a good thing.
Right.
That we're grateful that we're able to serve all these people. But it's getting harder and harder to do
well,
that
it's certainly
under the existing
taxing,
resources.
Right. It's taxing the organization's resources, especially from a personnel perspective.
Yeah.
And, you know, to see day after day, you know, every 15 minutes, a woman coming in who really needs your help and might need housing and might need medical care. And, you know, we have to treat every one of those women that walks in the door as if she is the only woman in the world,
right.
You know, who needs our services.
Which takes time.
Right. Of course it does. You know, when we try to provide those wraparound services for the woman. And of course, the goal at Aid for Women is not only to help any woman who comes to us to bring her child to term, but also to make sure that we put her on a path of self-sufficiency mm-hmm. and independence.
Good point.
So that, you know, 2 years from now, we don't have a woman coming back to us in the same situation. We want her to be able to have a job, have an education, really make good choices in the future.
And it works.
Yes,
There's
it does. Oh,
women
we have
out there, and
yep.
The videos are out there of people have been helped and saved.
So, yeah, if there's any of our listeners who are interested in finding out more about Aid for Women, you can go to the website at helpaidforwomen.org. But in terms of where you might be thinking of spending your charitable dollars, in addition to supporting the airtime here at Winds of Change, because we are listener-supported, you may also want to consider, you know, as Mother Angelica used to say, putting Aid for Women between your phone bill and your electric bill there, because every little bit helps us to continue to serve the women who come to us. And but, you know, just to go back to the bill, Bob, and Wesley Smith, who's a medical ethicist, wrote about this in National Review. He actually picked up on this Illinois mm-hmm. law, which is mm-hmm. interesting because a lot of people who do medical ethics are noticing this bill and how insidious it is. So he said, truly, the way in which it is written, if it is passed, it has been passed, but if you take it to its logical conclusion, that also means that if a patient comes in to a Catholic hospital and would like assisted suicide, you would have to counsel them about the benefits of assisted suicide. And even though we are still protected from doing them,
mm-hmm.
we might have to refer to an assisted suicide clinic.
Yeah, this applies to any, I forgot the terminology, you know,
medical procedure,
consultation,
correct, right.
Procedure, there's a laundry list of them. And so, to your point, assisted suicide, and what we would say is what you said before, there are none.
If right.
there are none. That would be the simple response, and it would be up to the state to prove that you're wrong, which I don't think they could. But that would be the response. But no, this doesn't only apply to abortion and the things that people typically think of, but it applies to anything.
And for right. another sort of hot topic of the day, it applies to patients who might come, particularly children with gender dysphoria and who want sex
right.
reassignment surgeries.
Right.
And if any of the listeners out there think, she's that's crazy talk. That'll never happen. The ACLU already brought a lawsuit against a Catholic hospital in California for refusing to do a sex change surgery on a patient who
that's
came
right.
to them.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
you know, we're already here, and California tends to be, you know, they were the first state to legalize abortion right after New York. They were, you know, the first to kind of move forward on some of these sex change things. California is sort of leading the way on this. And this is, you know, the horse is already out of the barn and running quite quickly along the field.
That reproductive rights project that the ACLU has is like I said, it is well-funded. They work hard. They have some very talented people on their side. And they have the resources to, you know, turn over every spade and interpret everything. And you know what it's like when you're facing a phalanx and a battery of lawyers that are all, I mean,
right.
and they have access to all these private
law
firms.
Oh, right, they
firms.
Have, yeah. I used to.
It's really tough
yes,
to be on the other side of
that. And that's a very good point. I often
amazing.
Debated Colleen Connell, who is one of the attorneys
sure.
who leads up that project for the ACLU. She and I were like the Punch and Judy of, you know, the pro-life abortion debates back in the late 80s and early 90s. And so, you know, I've gone toe-to-toe with her. But, you know, it would be me sort of by myself and Colleen her, you know, a team of six or seven
yes.
attorneys who
I've
had done
there.
All the research
right.
for her
yeah.
and had provided her with talking points and notes. And, you know, and it would be me, my wits, and
yeah.
everything that I could have written down on myself.
I have a real brief story about that. I know we have to go.
Oh, please, share.
But I had the same thing happen to me. I was on a Channel 11 or WTTW one time, and I think I was talking to you for advice, maybe somebody else. And I walk in literally, you know, with paper napkins and like handwritten notes, and I'm and I'm running because I was at some other meeting and I'm running to the studio and they put you in the little green room.
Right.
And there's like, you know, 12 people in there briefing her. And I'm thinking like, oh, come on.
Yeah, and doing her makeup and doing her hair. And then, you know, you walk in. But, you know, I debated her once on that same television show. And it this is what we have. We have God.
Yeah.
And I wound up, you know, carrying the day. And so she's still not more powerful than God. Well, thank you so much. This has been
a
very excellent hour of conversation. And I'm so grateful to you, Bob, for making time for us.
Yeah.
This has been Mary Helen Fiorito sitting in today for Father Anthony on Winds of Change.
What's there to say when the world makes no sense? Do we search deeper truths or sit on the fence? Can you see? Can you see? Can you see? The winds have changed. We marvel and flatter such meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now.